Welcome to this special edition of ICTJ's podcast. Today we will be discussing the developments around the genocide trial of Efrain Rios Montt, former dictator in Guatemala, and his former intelligence chief, Mauricio Rodriguez Sanchez. This trial, the first such trial in a national context where a former head of state was charged with genocide, was proceeding with some 100 witnesses taking stand, talking about the massacre for which Rios Montt was charged, with expert witnesses, and getting to the point where verdict was expected in a matter of days before somewhat a bizarre turn of events derailed the trial, where the judge in the first instance court basically decided to go back 17 months in procedure on a purely technical issue. Then the trial court rejecting this order, constitutional court, appeals court getting involved, to the point where it is very difficult to understand what is actually happening at the moment. We are today speaking to Susan Kemp, a prosecution consultant with the ICTJ, who has worked on preparing criminal cases on behalf of victims groups in Guatemala for a number of years. Welcome, Susan.
Hi.
And Marcy Mirsky, director of program at ICTJ, with extensive experience in Guatemala, including working on its Truth Commission. Marcy, can you start by explaining to us what is the current status of this case? What are the issues?
Well, there's actually a controversy over what the current status of the case is. The judge who has been presiding over what we call the trial, which is in Guatemala called the oral phase of the proceedings of this trial, she and her three judge panel, there's a three judge panel that sees this, they understand the trial to be suspended while the constitutional court makes a decision regarding the annulment of the proceedings by a first instance judge, that is by a judge who oversaw an earlier phase of the judicial process. That's really where it's at. So it came to a grinding halt last Friday. While I think there are now 13 new defense challenges and counter challenges by the prosecuting side in the trial, and there's a series of decisions that need to be made by appeals court and by the constitutional court to in fact be able to answer your question. Which is a very basic one. Maybe Susie can explain a little bit about some of those different kind of what the different options are on the table legally.
And legal issues
that are being dealt with on that front.
I think among the major ones, Rios Montt has claimed since quite far back in the process that he is entitled to an amnesty. A controversy arose because of the court in which that request for amnesty was dealt with. Now, Rios says that it's the wrong court because he's not asking for an amnesty under the peace deal law, which was from 1996. He's asking for one that's from the mid-80s. So this issue is still pending. He's still claiming that his acts were covered by this amnesty. And that will have big repercussions. Obviously, it's a big international law issue. Secondly, we have the issue, as Marcy mentioned, of the annulment, unknown in judicial circles for a lower court to try to annul the proceedings of a higher court. And this is why President of the trial court, the three-judge panel, Yasmin Barrios, stated on February 19th that she regards this as completely illegal, and under the Constitution, judges will not follow an illegal order. Other issues relate to the acceptance of defence evidence, which was presented earlier in the process. The judge, who was in control of the process at that time, rejected some of that evidence, and the defence appealed. Later on in the proceedings, the trial court accepted all of the evidence that the defence wanted. So this is one of those points that could be considered moot. There was no breach of due process on that issue, but notwithstanding, the constitutional court still have to sort out at which stage this should have been dealt with. Another issue relates to the choice of defence lawyer. At one point, the trial court dismissed one of the lawyers and reappointed other lawyers to represent Rios Montt, one of whom is saying that I was treated like a public defender. The court made me represent this gentleman. But throughout the trial, again, it has to be stated that the trial court ensured that Rios Montt and Rodriguez Sanchez were always, at every moment, represented by counsel.
May I just interject here, too, that even though this may be one of these fine points, but under Guatemalan law, every lawyer is officially a public defender and by law must take up any case that they're asked to take up. So there's even debate over that challenge when a lawyer says, but I don't want to represent him. Under law, they're obliged, and also under their code of conduct as part of the Bar Association in the country. Yeah. So even on on what should be a simple, straightforward issue, there's there's difference of opinion over whether that right to defense was actually upheld by that decision.
To a layperson like me, one question emerges when considering these very deeply technical legal issues, and that is, why now? Why 2 days before the verdict is to be issued have these matters, could these matters have not been dealt with earlier or after the verdict is issued?
Let me just say that there's three different pieces of an answer. Actually, Susie may have another set of pieces to go on this as well. But I think the first piece is that these are not the first attempts by the defense to stop the proceedings with legal technicalities. There have been over 100 defense challenges to the process since November 2011. That's part of the reason why it's taken until now for the trial to advance, that each of those 100 challenges, procedural challenges, had to be vacated, had to be decided upon and vacated. So it's not a new tactic. It's also, a second piece of the answer is, it's the use of procedural technicalities has been a major part of defense strategy in all of the human rights cases related to violations committed during the conflict. Very rarely, in this case is no exception, has the defense developed a substantive defense. So the defense has focused on these challenges.
On procedure rather than the substance of the case.
On procedure rather than substance throughout all of these cases, including this one. And we saw that throughout the first, 19 days of the trial. I think the other part of the answer to your question, why does it come to this crashing halt 2 days before, is I think it was very clear that the folks who, the forces in Guatemala, the organizations, the people, the individuals, the sectors in Guatemala who were involved in conducting and benefiting from the war did not want a sentence. When all of the previous attempts through these procedural technicalities and other measures failed, they pulled out all stops and apparently found a judge willing to rule their way, even though she has no jurisdiction over the trial itself. And I think that's what we saw bring it to a halt, was that in a way we're seeing, just as the trial represents in many ways a reflection of institutional strengthening and building since the peace accords in 1996, that institutions that 15 years ago would never have been capable of hearing this kind of case, neither a prosecuting authority nor a court system that could have done it. What we've now seen, so that the case is a real reflection of change and consolidation and strengthening of those institutions, but we're, by having this come to a stop, we're also seeing the limits of that. What we're seeing is the sectors who were responsible for those violations, more broadly socially responsible, politically responsible, are not willing to accept the authorities of state institutions. They've never had to abide by state institutions, and they're not willing to do that now in this case. So I think that's what we're seeing. And I think that's the deeper reason for what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with Marcy, having worked on these cases, it's absolutely true to say that the defence lawyers of the military in these types of cases have never been known to fight the case on the evidence. It just hasn't happened. I think what they saw in this trial was public prosecutors and the victims' rights groups coming up with an exemplary effort to put together victim witnesses, macro witnesses, what we would call macro witnesses about the circumstances, expert witnesses. And it really caught them by surprise. Things have never got this far before. Previously, massacres which occurred in the same period while Rios Montt was president, including the Blandas Sánchez massacre, the Dos Heres massacre, and the Rio Negro massacre, the victims have had to fight for years and ended up going through the Inter-American process and, in some sense, some occasions, back to the Guatemalan criminal process. They're in it for the long game. So I think it's important to note that they are not taken aback by this strategy, and they will continue every effort to get to justice at the end of the day. In terms of the bigger picture, the civilian control over the military, it's a fight for democracy. And now we're talking about political control of the judiciary. This is a fight for judicial independence. The only people, in my experience, who have stood up for victims, and particularly marginalised Indigenous victims, have been public prosecutors and judges. And not by a long shot all of them, but a few of them. So, and I think it's very important to recognise that throughout all of this, these victims have always gone through the official channels. They may have had very many reasons to buy out of this project of post-peace democracy when they see what's happening to them, and when the backdrop of this genocide case is problems with land, problems with discrimination, problems with mining. This is one of many problems that they're facing, but they know it's a long game. They will continue.
Talking about continuing, where can we go from here? Where can this case go on the basis of what we know at the moment, in your opinion?
It can go forward or backwards, as so many things in life. It can go forward depending on how the Constitutional Court rules. There is a possibility, it's slim, that it could be taken up again from last Friday, a week ago, April 19th, and proceed through the remaining defense witnesses who had yet to be heard, and some additional defense evidence into the concluding arguments and to a sentence. That is where it left off. It could potentially go forward in that way. It could also, the proceedings that have happened to date could also be annulled to various pretrial stages. Everything from 2 months ago to 17 months ago, because these different defense challenges would have different implications depending on how they're ruled upon by the higher courts. So that's what we're waiting for the courts to decide on. And those are the possibilities, a range of possibilities on that front.
What would you say are the circumstances in which these decisions are being made? Is there political pressure, in your opinion, on the judges to rule one way or the other?
I think the fact that the trial was stopped is more than sufficient evidence that there are huge pressures on the courts to rule against going to sentencing. I think that's totally apparent. I think also just, if I may, that when the president of the country last week said that the country, the peace of the country was endangered, that was a further indication of the kinds of political pressure that are on the courts. He's saying if you rule, there will be violence in the country. What he needed to have said, what he needed to have said was, "I call you all to calm." We know this is a very difficult thing for a country to confront. We know we don't have a lot of experience in trusting our courts to do this, but let's let the courts do their job and let's be calm. that was the judicious thing to have said, not that if there's a conviction in this case, the peace is at stake.
Could the fact that President Molina came out in this way have anything to do with what was said in the trial by one of the prosecution witnesses where he was implied to have been involved?
It may have been a factor, but personally I don't believe it is the defining factor. The movements which are against this judgment and the trial in general would exist independently of the current president and his involvement or not in violence in 1982. I think one thing which is notable is that people who were involved in the peace process, certain figures from both sides, mainly people from the army side, are calling for things to be swept under the carpet. And they are asking victims who were not at the negotiating table to accept this and asking them to accept 30 years after the crimes that there won't be any justice. In terms of their arguments, a lot of them are saying, well, we don't want a conviction for genocide against Guatemala because it's a stigma. Oddly enough, they don't say the same thing about crimes against humanity and war crimes. But it appears to be that the issue of genocide is being used as a legal smokescreen because they think that it opens certain doors for the state to be sued for responsibility. That door is open anyway, whether or not this court rules on genocide or the other two crimes. So it is a difficult situation, the backdrop that the judges are working in.
This is something that I think is possibly the most revealing aspect of the trial, and that is how well it illustrates the current discourse, the current situation in Guatemala, and the difficulties in which such trials are held in national context. Marcy, what do you think is the possible impact of the current deadlock and the situation we are seeing on the country itself?
Well, I think there's on several levels. I think actually, ironically enough, while some of these forces who have called for an end to the trial have said if there's a conviction, it'll damage Guatemala's reputation, I think the biggest impact right now is the damage that's being done to Guatemala's reputation by having stopped the trial. It's really quite astonishing to see this part of it unfold. And I think there the damage has already been done to the country's credibility because of its inability to embrace its own institutions and let them do their job. I think that's one thing. I think another is that that it will have become clear to everyone that elite groups of power do not believe in the institutions of the country and do not believe that those institutions have any authority over them. I think that has huge implications in terms of any further advances in terms of the rule of law and what that means there. And I think on a third level, it also is a huge slap in the face of victims and of the disenfranchised in general. The disenfranchised who saw an opportunity in the courts to be enfranchised through the justice system. So I think that this is a way of telling those folks, no, you do not have a place here. No, you do not have rights here. No, you cannot find justice here. I think those several different levels is what we see as the impact. I think it will take a very long time for people to regain any of the embryonic confidence that there had been in the justice system working. I think it will take a long time, too, to find judges and prosecutors who are willing to be as brave as these have been in this case, which is absolutely exemplary, given the pressures that they're under. So I think there's implications all around in those at those different levels in those different spheres.
Could I add a positive note to that? I mean, you know, it looks bleak. The trial may go on, and we'll only have a couple of days to run, and then there would be a decision. That's the best-case scenario. Even if that doesn't happen, try turning the clock back 12 years ago when the Association for Justice and Reconciliation, the Victims Group and the Centre for Human Rights Legal Action put the case in. It would be unthinkable at that point to imagine the Attorney General being behind you a key public prosecutor with years and years of experience standing up and fighting for you, and judges trying to respect your rights. The moment of actually going through the trial would have been unthinkable. So I think it's good to realise that gains are already in the bag, and it's there to be lost. The game is there to be lost at this point. They're so near the finish line, and this could be an amazing leap forward for Guatemala and also for international justice worldwide.
Within the context of Guatemala that we've been discussing, there are various elements that need to be discussed, that public, international and national needs to be aware of. Yesterday was the 15th anniversary of the REMI report. We have all these issues around the security of the prosecutor, the security of the judges involved. What do you think are the key issues that international public, relevant institutions, national public in Guatemala needs to be aware of, needs to hear?
I think, I mean, timely in terms of the fact that Stephen Rapp is visiting Guatemala right now. The international community, many people in the international community are very interested in international justice. That community decided that Guatemala would not have an ad hoc tribunal, would not have a hybrid tribunal, and they went it alone. And this is what happened. A great effort by prosecutors, by victims, by some judges. At the end of the day, this is the most difficult situation in which to do this job. And they have got so far. I think in terms of security and pressure, the prosecutors and the judges have resisted all types of pressure, from the type of thing in the newspaper you can see, from the threats of violence. They're just trying to do their job. Figures like Stephen Rapp and others in the international community can show up personally. They can make representations to the president to ensure that the security of these justice operators, because in terms of what they are doing, they are going it alone, but they and also their opponents need to know that they are supported, not just domestically, but worldwide.
Marcy?
I mean, I think there's still an opportunity for the authorities in Guatemala to do the right thing, which is to allow the trial to go forward, to come to a sentence, to go through an appeals process, which everyone expected there to be even before the trial began. I think in many ways it would be to do further injustice to the victims if the decision were to have them have to start the proceedings all over again and to ask 98 community members to come back and testify again, or for all of the expert witnesses to come back and testify again, would be really heap a new injustice, especially on the victims. But I think there is still the opportunity to allow this tribunal to come to its conclusions, and then to go into appeals. That would have been the normal process in courts around the world. And one would hope that that will still be the outcome of this trial. It's hard, a little bit hard at this point to imagine that being the positive outcome, the most positive of outcomes being that outcome, but certainly it's in the hands of the Guatemalan highest courts to allow that to happen.
Well, what we can say with certainty is that we at the International Center for Transitional Justice, together with our friends in various different organizations, including the likes of Open Society Justice Initiative, will keep a very close eye on what is happening with the case, and will keep reporting to our audiences. Susan and Marcy, thank you very much, and we will speak again, I hope, very soon with some positive news from Guatemala.